This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
My name's Nathan Brackett. I'm an executive editor of Rolling Stone. Welcome to Rolling Stone Music Now. Today, we're devoting our first episode to the great David Bowie, his legacy in his last years, with tributes from Beck, Mick Jagger, Nile Rodgers. I'm also going to talk about some new music with a panel of Rolling Stone critics, and we're going to read some reader mail and throw the writer of our 5 Seconds of Summer cover story to the wolves. But first, I'm here with RollingStone.com news editor Jason Newman to talk about the age of surprise albums and the new surprise album from Rihanna.
The bane of music journalists' existence also.
Music journalists are really the forgotten victims when it comes to surprise albums, because we try to make plans, we try to do magazines
and
websites.
Prepare a little bit and nothing.
And then it doesn't work.
It all goes to pot. And speaking of going to pot, Rihanna last week, obviously we've been waiting 3 years for an album, and last Wednesday she put it out, Anti, her imminent album that is now out.
Indeed.
Via title.
And the single Work
with
is
Drake.
Is already a number one hit in 92 countries, maybe more,
like
possibly 185.
But she put this out on Tidal, and it was a little bumpy. Tidal accidentally leaked the album.
That's Jay-Z's
streaming service.
Can we say ill-fated?
We can say in the process of being and still ill-fated. The future's still uncertain, but there's been a lot of criticism.
It was certainly an ill-fated release.
It was ill-fated release. It came out early. They leaked it for about 20 minutes
which is all it takes.
20 minutes
is
all you need for the Rihanna Navy to just screenshot all the songs, put out the album, distribute it. Later that night, Rihanna puts the album out officially, gives it away for free, which will not be counted in the Billboard 200. So it'll be interesting to see how she sells the actual sales.
And I happen to be a big fan of the record, and we're actually going to talk about the record a little more with a couple key critics later in the episode. But first, I just want to ask you, Jason Newman, we are in the age of surprise albums. Can you talk a little bit about this phenomenon, when it started, what it means?
It really started in earnest in December of 2013 when, out of nowhere, Beyonce drops her Monster album. She had hundreds of people sign NDAs from choreographers and video directors and producers, and it was the best kept secret in the industry.
And it was I'm going to say earth-shaking, which sounds impressive, but it really was. I mean, like, this was one of the biggest artists in the world.
Arguably the biggest pop star in the world is able to hide something like this was a actual incredible phenomenon and feat for her.
The publicist had to deal with lots of angry calls, again, from the forgotten victims, journalists.
Why did we have
very
to do
cross?
And at night also she dropped it. But so that started in December of 2013. And then really 2014 and last year, you start seeing artists drop. It's kind of Wilco dropped one, and kind of artists all across all genres.
Maybe not a Beyonce level success.
Not a Beyonce, but
a excellent record, Star Wars.
But it was also almost like the mixtapes, right? Like the mixtapes back in the day, people just dropped mixtapes because they finished the album and it was done. Why would you wait on it? And I think what it speaks to is the diminishing power of the record label, where in the day...
This is the bigger point, really. Like, why is it happening now? Just to put a little bit of context, in the old days, record labels would tee up all these releases for the end of the year. They would have a marketing plan.
Right. They have a promotion plan.
You would actually have lists every month of which records are coming out and schedules that they would try to stick to, and maybe a couple big stars would slide.
Right.
But now that's kind of gone out the window, and most of the biggest stars, with a few exceptions, put out records whenever they want.
And if you needed lead time, you needed about 3 months lead time, because back when print magazines were more prevalent than online, and now it's maybe a little equal.
What do you mean?
You needed lead time to talk to journalists.
Right.
Now, you still need that, obviously, for a lot of artists, but it's a lot easier and it's less necessary for an artist to need their label in terms of pushing stuff out. So it makes more sense that if you are a superstar artist and you finish the album, there's less of a need to really wait all these months for the plan to put in place. You can just sort of drop the bomb on the internet and throw it on Twitter and then, you know, essentially run the internet for 24 hours until the next thing comes.
So basically like in the old days, Walter Yetnikoff or some other big label person could go and say, "Hey, Rihanna, if you want to get on the radio, if you want to get this out to all the, you know, all the
press. If you want marketing money, you want radio money, your album's done in June, you're going to wait till November.
If you want to be everywhere, you need us and you need to give us what we need."
Yeah.
Whereas now, basically the equivalent of Walter Yetnikoff is now sitting kind of quietly waiting, basically taking the Rihanna album whenever he can get
it. One could argue
and being happy about
the equivalent of Walter Yetnikoff now is like Daniel Ek at Spotify or, you know, like the guys who, the new tech giants.
He's going to be thrilled to hear that.
Well, that's what it is.
The last thing I'll add is that these rules really only apply to like the top 0.1% of artists. Like everybody else kind of still needs a little
there lineup. Is an argument when Radiohead did it and with In Rainbows. When Radiohead did that, the sort of pay what you want strategy, and everyone's like, "Oh, this is the future and every artist can do that." Not really. Most artists aren't Radiohead and don't have the name where they can command that. We're not at the level yet where sort of every artist is this very independent entity. But it does show the proliferation of it, of how many more artists are doing it over the past couple of years. It's
so
not,
like if
that's
you're,
not stopping.
If you're playing like a corner bar, you can't be like, "Surprise, the record's out!
And it's like,
oh my God!"
Fuck are you? Like,
it might not work.
No one's going to care. But it does show, like, this is not a trend anymore, I don't think. I think we're way past that. I think it's sort of one of the new things, just the new ways to release it. You know?
We have to get used to it. So
music journalists will never get used to it.
No.
We like planning.
No.
But we have to, yes.
Jason Newman, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And we're going to move on to David Bowie.
In the fear of all men. In the fear of all men.
I'm with senior writer Brian Hyatt to talk about the great David Bowie, who died earlier this month. Brian, you wrote a big portion of our cover story on his final years.
Yeah.
Putting aside the importance of David Bowie and how much all of us loved his music and how important he was to music and style and so many other things. I mean, he's someone who belonged to everybody. Geeks felt like they had some ownership of him, but then also somebody like Anna Wintour had to give it up to David Bowie. And so I feel like it took literally weeks. I've never seen like the extent, with the exception of maybe Michael Jackson. I don't know if I've ever seen a level of response to a musician dying in my lifetime, not including Elvis, which I was too young to really get a handle on. Brian, you dug really deep into the last 10 years of Bowie's life and also the last couple years, which are kind of one of the most amazing like end games I've ever seen of an artist's life. He had this incredible flurry of activity in his last months and finished his life with a remarkable album that was already getting incredible reviews. It was probably the best reviewed album, I think, as you pointed out, by an artist of his age and from the 60s and 70s classic rock school in years, since maybe Dylan's Modern Times. And then he died 2 days later. He also had a play called Lazarus, which was off-Broadway, was this avant-garde production, which you saw a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about his flurry of activity in his last year?
Yeah, well, he didn't want to have that as his last year. He was trying very hard to live. And at the same time, he was preparing all this art that would, if necessary, serve as a final statement for him. But what we learned is even though Black Star and Lazarus kind of artistically are incredible farewells, he was actually hoping to record at least one more album. And, you know, I spoke to Tony Visconti, who was his longtime producer and friend. And
probably closer, at least professionally, to anyone else. One of the longest relationships with Bowie professionally and personally than almost anyone else in his life.
Yes.
Would you say that?
So this is what Tony had to say about working with him in those last few months.
You know, he waits until the end of an album to really write, to finalize the lyrics. And I saw what he was writing for Lazarus and all that, and I thought, you canny bastard, you know, you're writing a farewell album, you know.
Wow.
And he just laughed, you know. he was so brave and courageous, you know. What we did in the studio, I guess, might be different from his family life, but I don't know. Perhaps he was being courageous to his family as well, but he certainly was courageous with us. And his energy was still incredible for a man who had cancer. His energy was brilliant.
Mm.
He couldn't work for very long. He worked for about 4 or 5 hours, and then he got pretty tired and had to leave. But what he does in 4 or 5 hours is more than anyone else does in a day. You know, he's smart. He was quick, and he knew what he was doing. Hmm. So here it is, like about just after, on the weekend, just before, just after Black Star was released, he FaceTimed with me on the computer, and he said he was thrilled that he had 5 songs ready for the next album. Hmm. And at that late stage, he was planning the follow-up to Black Star. And I was thrilled, and I thought, okay, it was acknowledged that it was terminal by then, but I thought, and he thought, he'd have a few months at least. Obviously, if he's excited about doing his next album, he must have thought he had a few more months.
Yeah.
So the end must have been very rapid. You know, I'm not privy to it. I don't know exactly, but he must have taken ill very quickly after that phone call.
Obviously, you try to stay professional, but doing an interview like that when a lot of that information wasn't out there and you're hearing it, it was pretty intense, pretty emotional.
Obviously.
But yeah.
Yeah. Can you take us back a little bit? Because there have been a number of stories that have focused on the last few months of Bowie's life. I feel like yours gets a little deeper, but you also put it in context of the last decade, which was kind of, I don't want to say the lost decade, but it was kind of a quiet decade, and starting with some health problems around 2004. Can you talk about that?
So basically what we now know to be the final act of David Bowie's life began in June of 2004. He's standing on stage singing a song called Reality As It Happens when he's struck by pain in his chest, and he had to leave the stage. The concert was cut short, and horribly was misdiagnosed as a pinched nerve in his shoulder. They had gotten like a doctor who worked with the president of whatever country they were in, and still the doctor screwed it up. So he's prescribed muscle relaxants. He's on stage in a festival in Germany a couple days later, makes it heroically through the show. And you can hear on a bootleg of him just nailing the final notes of Ziggy Stardust. That's the end of the show. Makes it down the stairs off the stage and collapses backstage. And they haul him away and realize that he has a blocked artery in his heart, emergency surgery. Right. And that was it. That was it for his life as a public figure.
It's amazing hearing that song, knowing that that's the last time he's going to sing that song on stage.
Yeah, you can find it on YouTube if you're so inclined. But the greatest part is, of course, he hits the final note, because Showman to the end. I mean, he must have known something really bad was happening to him, and he hits that note, which is great. It wasn't the end of his life yet, but it was the end of his career as a public figure.
He would play a few scattered charity shows, one kind of well-known one with Arcade Fire and Alicia Keys, but he never went on tour again.
Never went on tour again, never did an in-depth interview again, and it began this really interesting period when he was kind of hidden away in plain sight.
Right. And this is after a very active 90s where he did at least half a dozen records. He was available for interviews, was out there.
Yeah, there's a million interviews on the Reality album, which was his last album before this break. Like, you know, he was talking to everyone. Right. Totally accessible.
Right.
You'd never know what was coming.
Right. And so take us up to the first surprise record and then kind of what happened after that next day.
Well, so he spent that period doing a bunch of stuff. He taking his daughter to school. He told Mike Garson, his great keyboardist, that he really just wanted to be a dad, and that was before the heart attack, and he did that. He was painting and drawing, taking his kid to school, going to movies at the Angelica downtown.
He would talk about how he would sneak into movies if he didn't like the first one at the Angelica. I mean, there are a lot of really great details in your story, too. I mean, one thing is, he would actually take the subway, supposedly, which I can't believe, David Bowie on the subway.
Definitely taxis, let's put it that way.
All right, definitely taxis. And he had this incredible strategy for putting off people who thought he was David Bowie.
Yeah, this is from an essay written by one of his friends. Apparently, he would just carry around a Greek language newspaper with the hopes that...
I've never heard of that.
Yes, with the hopes that, you know, if you saw him, you'd be like, oh, that Greek dude looks a hell of a lot like David Bowie. And supposedly it worked.
I could see it working. I could. And then there was also something in your story about a tattoo that I don't think a lot of people knew he had.
Yeah, this is kind of incredible. One of his bandmates from Tin Machine said that while they were on tour in Japan around 1992, Bowie got a tattoo based on a drawing he did of Iman riding on a dolphin, and underneath it was the Serenity Prayer. So, because he's also in substance abuse recovery at that time.
Right.
But, yeah, I did not know that about that tattoo.
No. Between you and everybody else who reported on this story, we talked to maybe 20 or 25 people, people like a director of one of his music videos or a film who had some interesting things to say.
Well, I think the thing in question, he did a couple movies. He did The Prestige in the
2000s,
and he also did this movie, August. And the director, Austin Chick, of this movie, this is a little tiny indie movie, total flop, but Bowie approached the director through his agent and said, I want to do this part as like this .com executive. And the guy's like, okay. And they told they told him he basically had one precondition, which is under no circumstances, he said, was I allowed to direct him. Like he just had to accept what he was given, which is, and you know,
and he said the deal.
He took the deal. And he said in the end, he took a little bit of direction. You know?
Right.
So, but as you know, Bowie did what he wanted during those years, which was not a ton publicly.
He was not a public figure, but he definitely wasn't a hermit either. He was out there.
He was out there. He was on red carpets with his wife. He showed up for his son Duncan Jones's premiere of his movie Moon, great movie by the way. And so he was around, but he was mostly silent, you know.
And he left it as an artist. I mean, not to be flip about it, but I just can't think of a better way for an artist to leave in terms of having a couple amazing work out there.
Right. So he got his mystique back. Because what you have to do, right, as an artist who's been around a while, is the trick is to get past the stage when you're trying to stay relevant and ascend to a level where you're just a legend, where people are delighted to hear from you. And he pulled off possibly the best way ever of doing that, which is to stay silent for a decade. By that point, it wasn't just like, oh, here's a baby boomer artist peddling his latest album again. Oh, right. You know, so sick of hearing from. No, it was like he engineered this perfect total surprise album the next day, which no one had any idea about, and dropped the announcement on his birthday, and people freaked out. And apparently he told Bono, and Bono told us, that you know he was really delighted that people were so excited to hear from him.
Right.
Because you know, it just shows he wasn't sure, because he, in his mind, he knew that it had actually been a struggle to promote his last few albums. You know, just as all aging artists face, like people take you for granted.
Right.
You know, it's almost hard to remember now that everyone's freaking out in his absence, but I mean, people were taking him for granted.
And especially during the 90s, I would say, when he released his As we said, about a half dozen albums, and some of them were well reviewed, like Heathen, and some of them weren't.
Yeah. So, and then he turned it all around, and the next day was a very strong album. I think that the album that followed was much better, Black Star. But what happened was that he put out this album that had great songs on it, he made great music videos, and people were very excited about new David Bowie music.
Right.
And I think what that did was make him excited, and he told the music video director, I can't stop it. He said, I'm just creating. He was really on a creative roll, and what he may not have known at that moment and would soon find out is that he also had been diagnosed with cancer.
Right.
So what you had was this intense burst of productivity with the ultimate deadline against him. And,
right.
You know, what an amazing story. And he made his deadline.
Right. In the same issue, we talked to a lot of people about either their personal relationships with David Bowie or also just the effect that he had on them or his influence on them. One of them was from Mick Jagger. We're going to hear a little bit from this interview about their friendship and kind of their sense of competition.
And we kind of kept friends and used to, you know, hang out in London a lot together. And first of all, and he used to come around and play me all his music, and he'd always look in my clothes labels to see what labels I was wearing. When he would see me, he'd give me a hug, and then I could feel him like going behind the collar of my shirts to see what clothes I was wearing, what labels were. So we were hanging out in those early days, and then I remember him when he did the Gene Genie, you know, coming over and playing all that different mixes and stuff.
I love that Jagger is just copying to them, checking out each other's clothes, and you just imagine like the two most stylish men, you know, in the world are checking each other out.
Yeah.
Jagger also talked about his one and only collaboration with Bowie, which is kind of amazing, from the 80s, their cover of Dancing in the Street, which they actually recorded in one day.
It was such fun when we did Dancing in the Street, because, you know, we were both sort of hung up doing long studio. We'd spend ages in the studio, and that day we decided to do this cover version of that tune.
I love that.
And when we walked in, and all the musicians were ready, because we had to do the recording and the video in one day, which is like, we said, well, this is never going to you know, this can't possibly happen. And we just walked in and did like two takes with the musicians and walked out and went straight onto the set of the video and did the video. And when we couldn't believe it, when we came to the end of the day, we were so funny. We said, you see, it can be done. Why are we spending, you know, years in the studio? But anyway, no, it was a great, you know, that it was such a fun work thing, but it was such a, you know, it was the only time it really cooperated on anything, which is really stupid when you think about it. But, you know, it was such a good work thing, but it was also a great fun day, and we really enjoyed ourselves camping up, and it's hilarious to watch.
We also talked to Beck, who is on the record as a huge Bowie fan. He covered Sound and Vision for this big interactive thing with a full orchestra a few years ago. Once you start listening to Beck and Bowie together, you realize what an important influence he was.
To me, he's such a central figure in modern music.
Yeah.
I grew up with his music always around. I mean, when he started making records, pretty much tracks with my life to this point. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's always been a David Bowie record. Record or David Bowie doing something, and you know, and I think for certain musicians, he's a kind of guidepost or gravitational force. You know, he's something that you set course to mm-hmm. or measure what you're doing against. He really helped construct how we write and record and put songs together and think about music. So it's such a central figure. And then, you know, for me, it almost feels like losing, even though I didn't know him well, but in some unexpected way, it feels like losing family or something. Mm-hmm.
If you listen to Quicksand from Bowie's Hunky Dory, here, we'll just put it on for a minute.
I'm closer to the golden dawn, immersed in Crowley's uniform.
And then you put on Golden Age from Beck's Sea Change record. You can hear the influence pretty clearly.
Put your hands on the wheel, let the Golden Age begin.
Nile Rodgers, who famously worked with Bowie on Let's Dance, also came by the studio. And Brian, you talked to him.
Yeah, he was behind David Bowie's biggest hit, It's Easy to Forget. So here's Nile Rodgers talking about how David Bowie brought him a picture one day that defined the entire aesthetic of the Let's Dance album.
He came to my apartment, he knocked on my door, and he had his hands behind his back like this. And he says, "No, darling, this is what I want my album to sound like." And it was a picture of Little Richard
right.
in a red suit, getting into a red Cadillac, and it was all monochromatic. Richard's hair was like dyed kind of red, suit red, Cadillac red, it was just red. And as soon as David showed me that picture, I understood it as well as a perfect mathematic equation or a perfectly written sentence. I mean, just perfect. I understood right away in a nanosecond. I thought, oh, he wants a record that sounds like it's from the future, even if we release the record in 3020. Because that's what this Little Richard picture looks like. This looks like they just took this picture this morning, and that's a 1960 Cadillac. But it looked like they had just taken that photo that morning right out in front of the building. And I knew that he wanted the record to be evergreen, but that's the last thing he wanted me to say. He wanted me to hear it from the way that this thing looked.
And here's Nile Rodgers talking about the pretty eclectic band that he assembled for the Let's Dance album.
He had this sense that these disparate people from these backgrounds that don't match. Your bass player is Puerto Rican named Rojas. Your drummer is named Omar Hakim. Your guitar player is Nile Rodgers. I'm named after a river in Africa. And, you know, it's like, and then you got Steve Ray Vaughan coming up from Texas. You know, it's like, that's your band.
Right.
And it was killing. It was a killing band. It was ridiculous. We did everything in one take. Just whipped right through that record. When I saw the look on Steve Ray Vaughan's face when he heard that track, Let's Dance, and I saw him listening, I've been around brilliant, schooled musicians my entire life. I was raised with like geniuses. I saw this guy calculating where the space was. Where do I speak in this record that's complete? This record is already complete to Stevie. He's sitting there like grooving it, like, man, this is incredible. Where do I fit in? And boy, didn't he fit in? I mean, it was like he plays one note when he goes, bam! Okay, that's the note.
Now also talked about how he was able to sort of knock Bowie out of some old habits and convince him to try something radically new on the song Let's Dance.
Once David charged me with making a hit, I felt that a lot of his songs were lacking in ear candy at the top of the compositions. And I explained to him that every song I've ever written starts with the chorus. And he says, really? Why? That's crazy. You build to the chorus. I said, yeah, if you're white, you build to the chorus. I said, shit. I start with the chorus because I know that every guy who's the promotion man who's going to get your record added at the radio station is going to go home with a pile of records under his arm that weekend, play it for his kids, and the one that the kids say is the record, that's the one he's going to get added next week. So my records go, do-do-do-do, we are family, one, two, ah, freak out, brrr, good times, we, like right away. So I said, David, I want the first words out of your mouth to be Let's Dance. Oh, really? Really? No, usually I would build up and we go, no, no, please, man, come on. Let the first words, like the first words go, freak out. The first words are, we are family. The first words, Let's Dance. So Let's Dance turned out to be a hit. 11 million seller. I mean, like, insane.
Look up here, I'm in heaven. I've got scars that can't be seen. I've got drama, can't be
seen. All right, we're going to talk about some new music. I'm here with a couple of our senior critics, staff writer Brittany Spanos of RollingStone.com and reviews editor Simon Vozick-Levinson. First of all, everybody's talking about the new Rihanna record.
Oh, yeah.
Simon, can you tell me a little bit of the history? Because Rihanna is one of the biggest stars out there right now. She was on a real pop schedule for a while. She was putting out an album once a year.
Right. From 2006 until 2012, Rihanna put out an album almost every single year. It was a really regular schedule. She could reliably generate pop hits and an album.
Right.
But then she slowed down. Her right. most recent album was toward the end of 2012, Talk That Talk. And since then, there's been this sort of pause where Rihanna's fans have been kept waiting.
Right. Can you talk a little bit about the new record?
So this album, after months and months of anticipation, I think Rihanna's Navy built up a healthy level of eagerness to hear it, dropped sort of semi by surprise on Thursday night. And it's great. It's amazing. It's a real left turn in a lot of ways. I think it's her most kind of album. It feels a lot less like a collection of pop singles and more like a kind of cohesive experience that takes you to a new and interesting place.
Brittany Spanos, how does this record fit into the scheme of Rihanna records?
This is definitely Rihanna's riskiest and her just most experimental album. And I also think it's a really great glimpse at off-day Rihanna, sort of just like Rihanna just like listening to psychedelic music and sort of making these really beautiful and hypnotic sounds and showcasing right. how much she's willing to sort of be like, I'm not going to make the same sort of pop songs that I was making for so long and
right.
kind of want to go in a new direction.
I mean, I think you're right. I think it feels, to my ears, like the first true Rihanna album.
Yeah.
It's like it's got a vibe all the way through.
Even, so
even
cohesive.
Even Work, which is clearly like an awesome single, is really as much about the vibe as the chorus. I mean, it's got mm-hmm. a chorus, but the producers call it this future dance hall vibe. Something that you never been. But I wake up and nothing's wrong. Just get ready for work, 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 work. You tell me I'll be work, 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 work. You see me do me da, da. What's your favorite song, Brittany?
I think that it's been sort of transitioning throughout the day, but I have to say that the Tame Impala cover is one that I've been going back to because it's such a
shock. Wait, yeah, we have to just talk about this for a little bit. Like, how does this fit in, a Rihanna Tame Impala cover?
I feel like it's sort of like the thesis of the album. Like, she is not going for this radio-friendly, sort of like, it seems like it's meant to be anti-radio. This right. entire thing is against the grain of what we expect from Rihanna.
Well, yeah, for people who don't know Tame Impala, they are like a quintessential Australian indie rock band who headline Governor's Ball, kind of like psychedelic, and Rihanna covers
Same Old Mistakes.
Right.
It's incredible. Like, she does like a really standard cover of it, but somehow her voice makes it even better. And I hadn't heard that song until I listened to the Rihanna album. So then I went back and I was like, oh, this is so cool.
Right.
Yeah. That pairing.
So how would you compare it to the original?
I like this a lot more.
Right.
Right.
I'm also a Rihanna stan, so I'm like...
Yeah, I mean, I think that song, Same Old Mistakes, was a strong highlight on Tame Impala's album last year, but somehow it just opens up new worlds when Rihanna sings it. It feels like that's the voice that song always wanted to have.
Right.
And just to, I mean, that pairing is so unexpected. You know, Rihanna, one of the biggest pop stars in the world, and then Tame Impala, this sort of, you know, weird, cool, psychedelic band. It's sort of like if in the 60s, the Supremes had covered like a Syd Barrett song. It's like, it's so out there and unexpected, but it works perfectly. Feel like a brand new person.
We're also going to talk about the new Macklemore single, which has gotten a lot of attention. It's 8 minutes long. It's called White Privilege 2. It's actually the sequel of a song called White Privilege off of the last album.
No, it's before that. It's from an album called The Language of My Mind from 2005. This is before Macklemore blew up when he was just an underground backpack rapper from Seattle.
And it's kind of, I mean, I have to say, whether you like it or not, it's a pretty amazing track. It's him looking at his place in the world as a white rapper. It's addressing racism in America head on.
Exploited and stolen, the music, the moment, the magic, the passion, the fashion you toy with, the culture was never yours to make better. You're Miley, you're Elvis, you're Iggy Azalea, make it so plastic, you've heisted the magic, you've taken the drums and the accent.
Brittany, what did you think of it? Like, is it good?
The positives of the song before I get into all of my
it's very diplomatic of you.
I love the structure of it. I love Downtown too. So I really love these kind of longer, really dramatic stories that he's telling with the new songs.
Right.
It kind of reminded me sort of just all these different scenes that he sort of placed within this one greater story of him going to this protest and like encountering a parent who's talking about how he's the only rapper that she'll let her listen to and all that
stuff.
He
kind of like recapitulates like all like the classic thing that a white soccer mom coming up to him might say.
Like calling the song One Love.
Right. Oh, you're not like those other rappers. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was really theatrical to me, the way that he set that up. And I love that aspect of it.
Right.
But I feel like Macklemore has this intense guilt vomit. He just has to like talk about his guilt about things all the time.
Right.
And I respect it. And I think he has nothing but good intentions. But
it's about racism in America, but it's also about him, which is maybe the thing that has thrown some people off.
So the thing that I find fascinating about this song is that whether you love it or hate it, whatever negative thing you can say about Macklemore, you can assume that Macklemore has thought that about himself. And he's really taking the criticisms that were unleashed against him in the last year or two and really addressing them head on. So Macklemore was correctly, I think, in many cases, criticized for getting rich by making a form of music that was pioneered by black artists, by taking it, exploiting, appropriating music. He owns up to that in this song, and that's something that I find actually fascinating. I think that's something that virtually no white artist has ever done in the long history of white artists making music forms that were pioneered by black people.
I think I come down more on your side, Simon, in the sense that, like, whether I like everything about this song, I have to respect him for doing it. There's no part of this song where you feel like, oh, he didn't really think this through. Maybe I don't love every minute of it, but, like, he certainly went there.
He went there. He's grappling with these uncomfortable issues, and there aren't easy answers to these questions. And I think that there are questions that not only white hip-hop musicians, but white cultural critics like myself, white hip-hop fans, should probably be reckoning with. And I'll say that Macklemore has done more to reckon with it than I have or most other people I can think of have.
All right. Thanks, guys. Hip-hop is not a luxury. All right, we're back with our reader mail segment. I'm here with associate editor Patrick Doyle, who interviewed 5 Seconds of Summer.
Yes.
We're an Australian pop rock band who first got their start opening for One Direction and are now playing arenas and stadiums. We actually called them on the cover the hottest band in the world. You could argue that both ways, but there's no denying the fact that they're one of the biggest young bands in the world. There are only so many bands that are playing arenas out there. This particular story probably got more reaction than almost any other cover story. I'm exaggerating a bit, maybe since the Adele story, but in terms of like actual vociferousness on social media, this got a lot of attention. Let's talk a little bit about what you did with them. Tell me a little bit about like what kind of guys they are. You actually, I mean, this reads like a classic rock and roll profile.
Oh, thanks. Well, I went to LA where they all live in the same house. They're 19 to 21 years old and they've just kind of moved to LA and they go out every night. They're having a lot of fun. So I kind of was with them for a week of that. We went to a party at the weekend's house, which was fun. Never felt more out of place in my life.
Right. I mean, like, in a way, like, this is a pop band that got, you know, kind of pulled out of obscurity in a way by One Direction, who are a huge pop group, but they really want to be a rock. And so in a way, like, they in your story, they kind of got that. I mean, these guys behave like rock and roll stars.
Yeah, they told me that they struggled with whether they were going to tour with One Direction or not because they were worried about what that would say about the band, you know, going on tour with One Direction, because they think of themselves, they said, we're as hardcore as any other band, which might be a little bit of a stretch, but they have a side project called Wormsteen, which is a heavy metal, you know, death metal side project, you know, so...
Take that.
Yeah. So they're smart. They know if you play something on the radio or listen to classic rock radio, they know every song and they sing along to the lyrics, so... They are real rock and roll fans.
Well, let's get to some of the tweets. I mean, this came out over the holidays and almost immediately. This was a big topic of debate. Just a few of them. One Twitter reader tweeted at you, why would you write such a terrible lie about Five Sauce? I hope you get fired, which has not happened yet.
I hope you don't fire me.
It's not going to happen. And stop trying to sabotage Five Sauce because they're famous and you're not. You need to disappear. Poof, abracadabra. Bye-bye, LOL, choke please. This kind of went on and on. I want to read like one of the actual letters we got to the magazine. Okay, this is from a reader named Eliza. This is honestly one of the worst articles I've read. The writer just seemed to be trying to portray the boys as awful people. Everything quoted could have been taken out of context and twisted. It really had nothing to do with them as a band. The article only highlighted sex, crude jokes, and cursing. What about their fans, their success, the gratitude for each other and their band, the new album? Now, before I let you respond to that, Patrick, I would say you do talk about their new album and you talk about how they play, you know, some of the music as well.
Yes, but sure.
Why do you think it got this level of reaction from their fans?
Well, I think it was surprising because the fans had not seen that side of the band before. You know, they're talking about their past hooking up with girls and the things that they went through when they were coming up. They were very honest about it, and they were more honest than they had ever been. And I think the only way a lot of the fans know them is through Twitter and the direct line that they have to them. So there wasn't really an unfiltered way of seeing them yet. So some of the fans have their own idea of what these guys are like.
Right.
So this might conflict with that.
Right.
They have a documentary that they put out themselves, and it's good, but it's not like this story at all. They talked about they party every night. They throw huge parties at their house. They stay out until 4 a.m. a lot. And they're doing everything that a 19-year-old would do if he had moved from the suburbs of Australia to L.A. I think that the fans were being kind of hard on them. And I mean, the band gave me such good access that they didn't hold back anything and they didn't want to. And I think that, I mean, they were very cool about it. They let me stay with them in their trailer as they talked about everything.
So I guess the point you're making is that they gave you the access that a band that was expecting a tag along with the band profile with a Rolling Stone writer gave you. They were game to kind of just show the side of themselves.
Yeah. They would be talking about, you know, a lot of things. I don't know if you can say it here or not. And then they would look at me with like kind of a smirk. They were having fun being a little more controversial than they've ever been before, which that's what kind of made the fans. But they were very funny. And I hope that came across in the piece. They were very funny guys. They weren't saying this anything with malice or anything like that.
I ended up liking them by the end of it. And there were, in fairness, there were like fans who seemed to kind of get the same point. This is from Sophie, another letter. Everyone keeps saying that this article makes Five Sauce out to be bad people or something, but I completely disagree. This is the God's honest truth, and I love it. I am a massive fan of the boys, and this is exactly the type of article I want to read about them. It's not the typical, what was your first album? It's just an observation and report. Massive stars drink and party and have sex with more than one person, and that doesn't make them bad people. I believe the author did a wonderful job showing this without seeming biased.
Oh, thanks.
Sophie, all right. I think we're going to end this on a positive note. Patrick, thanks for coming.
Thank you, Nathan.
All right.
Yeah.
And that's it for today. Thanks for listening to the first episode of Rolling Stone Music Now. We're going to be available on the iTunes Store every Monday, so please subscribe on the iTunes Store and keep listening.